there is a level of rage that I think is totally justified about a system that's totally broken. And what feels like, you know, if you look at dictatorships around the world, there'll sometimes be an opposition party where people are like, you know, getting jailed by the dictator, but they're fighting and they know the stakes. And people want to feel like they're a part of a movement that understands the stakes, understands the kind of fight that's needed. And I, you know, for better or worse, the good news and the bad news is the way that you build this is exactly the way you build political power. It is from below. It is by people just doing it. When you raise a beacon and say, the fight is right here, join me, let's go do this. People come. People respond to that. And that is something that
100%.
It is fight by fight and state by state. And it rolls up to how the National Party operates. But I think when people talk about, you know, the Democratic brand, a brand is not your logo. It is not your three-word bumper sticker. It is the totality of everything people see you do.
Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good night and good luck.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Lincoln Project Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Rick Wilson. And before we get started, I would love for you guys to go click the like, subscribe, or follow key if you're looking at this or watching this or listening to this on the Apple products. Hit that follow key. Really appreciate it. It means a lot to grow the channel and to grow the content and get it out there to more and more people at a time when we feel like, yeah, kind of need to hear some of it. Today, I am thrilled to be joined by my friend Ben Wickler. He is an amazing political operative and thinker. He ran the Wisconsin party and helped mount a lot of the comeback we've seen in Wisconsin over the last 4 or 5 years. He has a new book coming out that you are absolutely going to want to read. It's called This is the Plan, How to End America's Meltdown and Save Democracy. It's coming from Norton, also my publisher. And you are going to absolutely, this is going to be vital reading, folks, as we go into 2028, because Ben is a guy who has a very clear-eyed look at how to win, and how to win matters. Ben, thank you so much, brother, for coming on the show today. Tell us about the book. Let's get right to it.
Rick, it's great to be with you today. Great to be with all your viewers and listeners. We are in a moment of crisis, as I think all of us know. We've seen this movie play out in other countries. It's called Authoritarian Breakthrough. It's where somebody tries to smash a democracy to pieces and lock in power permanently. And there's a way out of it. And I know this from experience because Wisconsin had this exact same thing happen when Scott Walker came in 2010. And then he changed all the rules. He gerrymandered the living daylights out of the state. He smashed the unions. He suppressed the votes. He defunded, you know, schools and public institutions. He changed campaign finance law. He did everything in his power with an assist from a rogue Supreme Court at the state level, not the national one, with a totally compliant state legislature, just like our Congress now. And it almost worked. He almost snapped Wisconsin like a twig. And then thousands of people fought back and we fought our way out of it. And so what I write about in this book is to, you know, what we did in Wisconsin and how we can map that onto what we need to do nationwide. And if I want to sum it up in one thing, it is that it is not enough to beat the guy at the top. This is the rot
through
the whole system. The Trump is, you know, both symptom and disease, but you need to fight for every level of government. And at every level, you need to think not just about how you want to deliver for people, which is essential. You need to think about the rules, because the far right playbook, the authoritarian playbook, is to get power and then wish for more wishes. It is to change the rules to make sure you never lose power, even when the public doesn't want you to be in charge. And you need to unrig the system as soon as you have the power to do so at every level, if you want to avoid coming right back to where we are now.
I love that you're putting this out there. I have been preaching this story for years, because I was around for the Tommy Thompson era in Wisconsin when it was laying the groundwork. And I won't put Tommy Thompson in the same categories as Scott Walker, but he was laying the groundwork. And in Wisconsin, in Florida, in other states that I worked in, we built from the ground up. I tell the story a lot. People are like, how did you take over the legislature in 10 years? How do you Republicans do it? I'm like, we started by electing people to city council and school board and sheriffs and water conservation districts and soil management districts and mosquito control boards. I don't know if you have those there, but it's the small stuff that counts.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it.
You build a farm team.
Yes. And people build trust. You know, when people vote for someone, you get to know them. When they serve your community, that's how you get the trust to be able to move up the ladder, especially in a place where people don't vote for your political party most of the time. But this happened in Wisconsin. We saw the whole thing, the swing to the right. This is a state with this very deep progressive history. The progressive movement, capital B progressive movement, was born in Wisconsin. But if you look at our laws, even now, because Republicans still control the state legislature for the next few months, we're about to change that. I'll talk about that soon. But even now, we haven't expanded Medicaid. We have one of the most restrictive voting laws in the entire United States of America. There's a school funding crisis that continues, despite wonderful work by folks and Democrats in the legislature, Governor Evers.
Yeah.
All that is because of this long-term plan that was hatched and executed by the right. But now the shoe's on the other foot. So we have been cleaning up in school board races, in city council, county council races across the state.
Judge races.
Local judge races. All these things build one to the next. And if someone who is watching or listening right now wants to be part of this, the amazing thing is that so few people ever think about these local races. That your time as a volunteer, the doors you might knock on, the folks you might call, pick up your phone, think about who doesn't always vote in local elections. You can make a huge difference in these local races. And if you have a long-term plan, this rolls up to changing power nationally. Like the work that we did in the 2020 state Supreme Court race, that wound up discerning the deciding vote in the ruling that prevented Wisconsin's presidential election from being overturned that fall. And that race, nobody would have paid attention to it if it hadn't been for this enormous effort by thousands of people. We lost the previous one. We won that one. And if we hadn't won that one, Wisconsin's election would have been overturned. And there are races like that happening in real time almost every Tuesday across the country. And all of us have the power to change the outcome.
And you guys are showing off in Wisconsin a fact that people that I think on the Democratic side, call it progressive, Democrat, liberal, whatever side you want to call it, pro-democracy side, they get depressed. They're like, oh, well, Elon Musk will just come in and spend $1 billion or $1 billion and we'll lose. You guys have beaten Elon freaking Musk now.
Oh, well, about that. So here in my book, the opening.
Yes, this is the plan.
This is the plan, how to end America's meltdown and save democracy. I'll just read the first sentence. I feel like this is one of those things that may not seem that it's going to affect the entire destiny of humanity, Elon Musk told the crowd in Green Bay, Wisconsin on March 30th, 2025, shortly after taking off a cheesehead. But I think it will.
I should say that the reason, the reason for the checks is that it's really just to get attention. It's like we need to get attention. And it's somewhat inevitably, when I do these things, it causes the legacy media to like kind of lose their minds, and then they'll run it on every news channel, and I'm like, I couldn't pay them it would cost like 10 times more.
Now, he meant when he buys this race, he's going to change our state Supreme Court, lock in power for the right. I think it did change the destiny of things because he lost by 10 percentage points. We were able to turn that race with this amazing candidate, Susan Crawford. She, thousands of volunteers, we turned it into a referendum on whether Elon Musk should be able to buy democracy, buy Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And we said, absolutely fucking not. And we threw him out on his ass. And Elon Musk then was kicked out of the White House. He became a political embarrassment in the Trump White House. Trump told reporters the next day that his time was drawing to a close. And, he's still doing all kinds of terrible things, but he's not killing hundreds of thousands of kids by shredding foreign aid programs every day because he doesn't have the power to do that anymore.
Right.
Thanks in part to the people of Wisconsin rising up and fighting back.
This is something that Wisconsin's been great about mobilizing this. It does stem partly from your progressive tradition of activism in the state, which not every state has the same kind of coherent historical tradition, which is okay. It's fine. You can, this book shows people how to build that, how to recreate that, how to take the best practices and the lessons that you guys have applied in pushing back on this. And I'm interested in your thoughts on, there's a huge amount of frustration with rank and file Democrats, with activists, with donors. I speak to with elected officials. I speak to these people all the time. I speak to a dozen people a week in various levels, whether it's a billionaire donor or a state assemblyman somewhere, just frustrated that the party doesn't work, that it doesn't get out and fight. They want to see fighters. And I'm curious about your perspective on how do you get that fighting spirit up to the national level? Because that's where the frustration, I think, with Democrats is playing out with these DSA candidates getting elected. It's not that people are like, I want to seize the means of production. It's like, I want somebody who's going to go punch bad guys in the goddamn face.
There is a level of rage that I think is totally justified about a system that's totally broken. And what feels like, you know, if you look at dictatorships around the world, there'll sometimes be an opposition party where people are like, you know, getting jailed by the dictator, but they're fighting and they know the stakes. And people want to feel like they're a part of a movement that understands the stakes, understands the kind of fight that's needed. And I, you know, for better or worse, the good news and the bad news is the way that you build this is exactly the way you build political power. It is from below. It is by people just doing it. When you raise a beacon and say, the fight is right here, join me, let's go do this. People come. People respond to that. And that is something that
100%.
It is fight by fight and state by state. And it rolls up to how the national party operates. But I think when people talk about, you know, the Democratic brand, a brand is not your logo. It is not your three-word bumper sticker. It is the totality of everything people see you do. And we are world of constant distractions, of a million noisy things. The only thing people are going to notice is when sparks actually fly. The only thing that breaks through is when there's a fight. People understand which side you're on and what the stakes are. And they see you actually, you know, taking a risk to stand for something that is actually going to mean something in people's lives. So what I think of is the way you fix the Democratic brand is you fight like hell to make sure that people don't lose their health insurance constantly because of tax cuts for billionaires. You fight like hell to make sure that in every small town across the United States of America, the schools aren't closing because they got defunded in order to fund a tax cut for the biggest donor to the Republican Party. This is elemental stuff, but you have to focus it on people's actual lives, and you have to show that you're willing to go to the mat. And if you don't do that, then it's just blah blah blah, you know, claptrap. People tune it out. It fades into the background. And that to me is the thing that we've seen over and over in my state in Wisconsin, but we also see it around the country now. There are amazing candidates. They're running for offices at all these different levels, and it's across the, you know, from the far left to the center left party. Yeah, like there's tons of room ideologically. The uniting thing is an understanding that this is a system right now rigged by people at the very top who want the country, our politics, to be like a marionette where, you know, if Elon Musk says jump, everyone says how high. If Donald Trump decides, you know, he's going to pull the plug on something that your family relies on in order to realign the reflecting pool, then no one's going to raise a peep. And you have to be able to fight against that in a way that is not fundamentally left or right. It's really top to bottom and bottom up. If you want to be able to have a prayer of changing how people think about what Democrats are about. They need to see that Democrats are them, are about them, are fighting for them in every square inch of the country, not writing anywhere off. And if we do that, I do think there's a chance in 2026 that this could be a sea change moment. And we have 100%. To make it that, because if we don't win, and I want to just draw a huge underline around this, the threat to the possibility of a peaceful transfer of power in 2028, the biggest threat is at the state and local level, because the states run elections. So if people like Wisconsin, we've got a guy, Tom Tiffany, running for governor. Tom Tiffany tried to overturn the 2020 election. He was one of the members of the House who said, throw out the electoral college votes. If he becomes the governor in Wisconsin certifies the presidential election. So you'll have a guy who tried to throw out a presidential election in charge. We need to win those races in 26 to make sure that what the public wants turns into political reality in 2028.
You know, Ben, that's such a good point. And the idea of people, you know, it's a Southernism, but I use it a lot because I'm a Southerner. when you're at a dog fight, people want to see some fight in the dog. And I made that point the other day on MSN, and Max Rose, who's from, you know, former congressman, nice guy, lovely guy. He's like, but I'm like, this is the end of the era of the sternly worded letter. You can't shame these people with a sternly worded letter. You have to go out and beat them in the electoral space like they are a rented mule. You have to go out there and just whip them in the electoral space. And I think that that is sort of the spirit of this book and sort of the spirit that you brought to this. I think that if you had won the DNC race, it would have been a very different vibe for the last 2 years. You know, God bless Ken Martin, nice guy, but not a fighter, not a wartime consigliere, as they say in The Godfather. I want to talk to you a little bit about one of the things that we all deal with, and we work with it here. You started a new partnership with Civic Media. Great guys, by the way. I've been on their programs a ton. We know them. They're you know, friends of the family. Talk to us about what you're starting in Wisconsin with Civic Media on This Is Wisconsin.
Absolutely. So This Is Wisconsin is a project to go all over the state. This week I went in Stoughton for the Stoughton Fair, the 100th anniversary of the Stoughton Fair, talking to families that were showing pigs and showing goats, talking to the folks operating the rides. I went to Appleton yesterday, I talked to a mom who realized that with her job and her childcare costs, she was only making $8,000 a year once she paid for her kids' childcare. So she wound up leaving her
Mother
job.
Mother of God.
I know. It's like infuriating. It does not have to be like this. We used to have childcare during World War II in the United States, but as a country,
yeah, we did.
We're going to need both parents, you know, one fighting, one making ammunition. We're going to have to provide childcare. And then we just stopped doing it. And now here we are, and we expect both parents to work and families, and we make it almost impossible. So she left. She started a business making the marketing for car washes. And so I learned all about car wash marketing. And she's making,
you know what? God bless.
God bless. Absolutely. It's called Omco. Her husband wound up succeeding. Her husband left his job, works with her, two-person company. But it's like small. My argument with This Is Wisconsin is this is Wisconsin. It is people figuring out how to roll up their sleeves and make it work in small towns and rural areas and big towns in Milwaukee and Madison, like wherever you are. That's actually the life of our economy is people who are figuring out how to carve a path. And we just need to make it a little bit easier to be able to do that for everybody in a system that is built for the people at the top.
Yeah, Ben, that reminds me of something that I try to make a point about with Democrats when they're campaigning now is the Republicans have one word they use. It's communism. It's all communism. The Republicans are not any longer about a free market. They're not about entrepreneurs succeeding. They're not about small family businesses succeeding. They're not about small farms or farms at all succeeding unless they're corporately owned. They're not about anybody making a comfortable life for themselves, except for the 1,000 people at the top of the RNC's donor list.
Yeah.
And those people are doing great. Those people are killing it. They are making bank. But the combination of monopoly power and stacking the regulatory deck for their friends and their allies, you know, all of it strikes me as a way to get back some of those voters the Democrats lost over the years, because there was a long stretch where what was a cliche of, you know, the Main Street businesses are the fundamental core of America's economy. They felt like they were not respected by Washington Democrats. And you could make the argument, but now the Democrats have an opportunity to say, we're the only people that are going to help you get that business going. We're the only people who are going to help you support your family while you're trying to build something for a legacy for your kids. And the other guys, they're going to try to hand over all of your wealth and your life to the AI companies and to private equity companies and to data center companies. And that's it. That's all they care about.
It's exactly right. If you think about it, the tariffs illustrated this perfectly. So Trump comes in, he puts in place all these tariffs, and then immediately word goes out among the insiders that the tariffs don't have to apply to you. All you need to do is write $1 million check to Donald Trump's super PAC. Yeah, you give some little money on the side to someone in the administration, hire the right lobbyists, you know, somebody who has Donald
Kiss
Trump
his ass in public.
Kiss his ass,
you know,
in
give
public.
Him a gold statue in the office.
Oh, you've got your exemption. And so these were tariffs that only applied to the people who were not on the inner circle of Trump world, who didn't have the money to throw at the political system. It was corruption personified. And I've talked to small business people, to farmers, to folks all over the state of Wisconsin who were hit in the face by these tariffs, and they didn't have the connections to get an exemption. Like this is not something that regular people had access to, whether they voted for Donald Trump or against him or didn't vote at all.
If you could pick one word to describe how it feels to be a farmer right now in America, what would that one word be?
Frustrated. And number one, because most of this situations have been caused by the administration's actions.
This was something that created a political dependence that allowed Trump and the people around him to get even richer and basically took the hide out of everybody else to pay for it. And
It's not conservatism. It's not oligarchic bullshit.
It's not how capitalism is supposed to work.
It's not even capitalism, right? It's not capitalism. It's not conservatism. Yes. It's not free markets. It's classic crony insider kleptocracy.
Yes.
Let me ask you a question about because you mentioned the tariffs. Wisconsin has taken a hard hit in the ag markets because of tariffs. And my family's in agriculture, and I live in an agricultural part of the South. I live in the country, basically. A lot of soybean farmers down here who are very MAGA have abandoned Trump.
Well, we depend on the Chinese market. And the reason we depend so much on this market is China consumes 61% of soybeans produced worldwide. The rest of the world is 39%. Of the soybeans that American farmers produce, 25% currently have been going to China. And right now, we have zero sold for this crop that's starting to be harvested right now. So it's a five-alarm fire for our industry that 25% of our total sales is currently missing.
We can't help but feel very anxious of wondering why it's taking so long to get this resolved.
Well, are you angry?
The farther we go into this season, the more we're going to lose. And China should have been buying our beans already, and they're not. It's like crickets.
A bailout is like putting a Band-Aid on a bullet wound. Government bailouts do not make up for our loss of income. They're designed not to. And they don't work. We don't want a bailout. We want markets for our crop.
These guys are red state, red voters, conservative, Christian, evangelicals. They're like, he screwed us. He hit us so hard. Is that the kind of story that this is Wisconsin is going to pursue with some of the Wisconsin, farm communities? Because I think it's such an important area for this to tell the story.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we grow a lot of soybeans in Wisconsin, especially in western Wisconsin. There's folks who grow ginseng. Ginseng gets caught in the battle with China, with the trade war Trump was constantly trying to inflict. So we'll absolutely be telling those stories and talking to people. How do what do you do when the president pulls the rug out under your farm that you and your parents and grandparents have been working for years and years? It was kind of bittersweet. Yesterday I was talking to someone who has this amazing business doing reclaimed wood, but a lot of the wood comes from barns. It comes from barns that are no longer in use because a lot of farms are shuttering. And there's now, people are coming up with new ways to do small farms and be able to make it work.
Sure.
But it has been so tough for the agricultural economy. And it is tough, not because people don't want the products. It's tough because the way the market is set up especially by this administration, just makes it so hard for people to be able to succeed in a small farm at a family level. And I think it's critical for people to see their own lives reflected in media and content and storytelling. Civic media is amazing at this. There's 25 radio stations around the state of Wisconsin that try to reinvigorate local media so that people see that they can make a difference in our democracy. And I'm trying to do that with this kind of storytelling. It's the other side of the argument of the book. The book makes the case to folks, wherever you are, your most powerful thing is the relationships that you have and building relationships, people especially who might not already agree with your politics. A lot of your listeners have family members that might vote different ways from them. what's called relational organizing. It's the most powerful thing you can do is when you have conversations with people, you find some kind of common ground and you think about what you can do about it. And maybe you can't get to someone to, you know, vote against the Republican candidate for president, but maybe you can move them on your state legislative candidate, because at least you can agree that the state legislature, you know, should stop doing terrible things. And that kind of work, the same thing to me it applies to media. You want to actually connect with people where they are in a way that they feel connected to. So it's not like politics is a spectator sport, something happening far away to you. It's something that we can actually create. We have power still. It is getting stripped away and attacked in all these ways, but we still have enough power right now to change who's in charge of this country, to change who's in charge of the states, to ensure that people lead our own communities that actually serve us rather than
absolutely
just serving the insiders. And if we use that power, we can do the reverse of the far right playbook. We can wish for more wishes to create more democracy and then have a government that actually serves regular working folks rather than the people living off the meme coin dividends that they got from Trump's rug pull scams where he fleeced the public for billions of dollars.
That, I think, is something that Democratic candidates really need to focus in on. Is they're now the reform candidates. They're the candidates who are going to be able to say, when I go to Washington or when I go to Madison or when I go to Tallahassee or when I go to Atlanta, I'm not going to trade stocks. I'm not going to conflict myself by letting lobbyists tell me, oh, you can invest in our company. If you pass this bill, you'll make a lot of money. We're not going to have that anymore. Democrats have a chance, and they need to get right with Jesus on this one in Congress in particular, because there's a lot of Democrats who trade stocks too, and they got to stop it. They got to cut that shit out. But Democrats have a chance. You've got the most corrupt president running the most corrupt administration and the most corrupt Congress in history by orders of magnitude, worse than the Grant administration, worse than Andrew Jackson. It is a pinnacle of corruption. And I think that Democrats have a real space there to be the party that's going to go clean it up. And they have one lesson in this in history in Watergate, which was like Watergate would have been like a 1 week Trump scandal comparatively. And the Democrats were able to go in and blow out the Republican majority, go in and clean up a lot of the campaign finance stuff at the time. It went imperfectly, but you know, they had a moment. There's a much bigger moment there right now, don't you think?
I completely agree. The people can see and they're seething about how incredibly corrupt the system is. And if you ask people on the street, they're not saying this is just a Republican problem, although Trump is the most corrupt it could get. This is a problem with our whole political system, and they want change. And here's the thing that I think is so critical to bear in mind. It is not enough just to have a plan that you put out or even just to pass a law, because right now the U.S. Supreme Court is going to smash to pieces any kind of serious challenge to the corruption of our system. So this is one of the maybe more controversial arguments in my book. We have to reform the U.S. Supreme Court. And that means not only anti-corruption things, but in my view, we need to either put in term limits to the U.S. Supreme Court or expand the number of justices. Because if we're in a world right now where whatever laws are passed that help Republicans get upheld, no matter how outlandish they are, and anything that tries to reduce the level of corruption in our federal government gets struck down, then it's a ratchet that moves us into worse and worse shape. One of the kind of villains in my book, I don't know how you think about this, but I think Citizens United opened the floodgates to a lot of the disasters we're seeing right now, and a slew of other rulings like it. I was an intern for Russ Feingold, who is the co-author of McCain-Feingold. And McCain and Feingold.
Oh, I told John back way, way, way back in the day, I encountered him one time and we were talking about campaign finance. And I said, this could have a lot of unintended consequences that you haven't thought through yet. This could be too cute by half. And don't worry about it. We got it. And John was a great man, but did not always see that even well-intentioned things can be turned to fuckery if they're not properly constructed. And they did. Citizens United opened the floodgates, and I have had to exist in that world for, two-thirds of my political career. I've had to exist in the Citizens United world. And I've done very well figuring out how to do it. but it's unpleasant. It's like cleaning out the sewage system of your septic tank. You don't want to do that job. You shouldn't have to do that job yourself. Some kind of reform at this point, especially because of the disproportionate amount of wealth that's available to one political party alone.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, I interned for Russ Feingold. Then I saw McCain-Feingold get struck down the same year, 2010, as the Tea Party wave. That's when Russ Feingold was defeated by Ron Johnson, who came in on the back of, you know, huge funding from these dark money super PACs and these ultra wealthy donors. That's how he's won his last two elections. And you got to fight fire with something that can defeat the fire. It might be water. It might be fire. But you got to fight with everything you've got. You cannot unilaterally disarm.
Do not disarm. Yeah.
But
listen, a lot of Democratic donors are like, a lot of Democratic donors are like, well, this system is so bad. What can we do differently? I'm like, until you understand that if you bring a pillow to a gunfight, the guy with the gun is going to win.
Yeah, you want to bring a bazooka to a knife fight. That's the that's my point of view on this.
Yeah.
You got to win, but then when you win, you need to change the rules. And that means the filibuster's got to go, and then we got to pass US Supreme Court reform. And it is not radical to do that. That happened over and over in American history. It used to be
the Supreme Court should function by the same ethics rules that the president does.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean the idea
be held to that
is like a no rule zone applying to the Supreme Court. You can hop around on Harlan Crow's super yacht and, you know, no problem.
Yeah. And take PJ rides from whoever wants to throw you their jet that week.
It's got to end. And, you know, but if we do this, so this is the plan in a nutshell. It is step one, this week, roll up your sleeves, get involved in organizing for local office where you are and where elections are closest. So if you're in a blue or red state, there's stuff you can do where you are. Do that. And also think about where it might come down to a handful of votes around the country. Step two, win in the midterms, 2026, fight for the House and Senate. Win those, I hope, but also win state level trifectas. Win state governments in places like Wisconsin and Arizona and, you know, Michigan, Pennsylvania. We can win in Alaska. There's all these states.
Sure.
Where we can win now that can defang the risk of 2028. And then step three is 2028. We have to win a federal trifecta and then use that power, break the filibuster, pass the U.S. Supreme Court reform, pass gerrymandering ban nationally. We might want to go to multi-member House districts and proportional representation. Basically, take the gun off the table. Because right now, we're in this moment where we're in a race to end competitive races for the U.S. House because Trump initiated these gerrymandered. We're in a world where the U.S. Senate only passes tax cuts for the rich because those aren't the filibuster doesn't apply to those. And then Democrats, you know, reverse them temporarily and Republicans put them back into place and then confirming justices, which is also not filibusterable because of the way that the laws work. And so Donald Trump goes around doing that. Any substantive legislation to make this country freer and fairer gets blocked by the filibuster. So it is a set of rules that only helps Republicans do their priorities, which is why the Republicans won't break the filibuster. They know it works out great for them right now for things that the public doesn't actually want.
Getting rid of the filibuster, non-starter, you don't have the votes?
Well, we don't. I've had this conversation with the president many times, I think, as you know. And I actually suggested at one point that his team come up and sit down and visit with some of my colleagues. So they came up, met with about 20 Republican senators and 15 were no on getting rid of the filibuster. The votes aren't there to do it. I know he thinks he can persuade people, but there are a lot of folks who are this is a hard position for a lot of Senate Republicans.
So you have to change that rule and then you can actually pass the laws, which to me includes union organizing rights, which has been, you know, that is
just beaten to death.
Beaten to death. And for working people across party, across the country, they have seen their share of the incredible bounty of this country fall and fall because the power of working people to demand their slice of the pie has been deliberately clubbed like a baby seal by an administration, by a movement that's worked for decades to do it. So restore union organizing rights, change our campaign finance laws, end the rigging of our political system, and pass laws that actually deliver for working people. And we can make real change that gets sustained, doesn't immediately get shredded because of a political system that is tilted to one side. That's the plan, and this is the plan.
I mean, Ben, that's why I'm so glad you wrote this book, is because there has been this on the right, this seduction of belief that, oh, well, we're fighting communism. We're the free market party. We're the small business party. We're the little guy party. We're the people who care about the middle of the country. And it's just a complete lie. It is rebranded. What they've built is this system. And again, as a conservative, I hate the system that exists now because it's not conservative. It's not small. It's focused on rewarding only the biggest players in the economy. I tell a story about from 2017, a friend of mine who's passed now was working on the big tax bill. And I still in 2017 was like, maybe we can, you know, work around Trump. Maybe we can figure some way out through this. And I called and asked him, I said, hey man, just tell me there's some middle class uplift in this tax bill. He goes, get the fuck out of here. He goes, I work for private equity, dude. He goes, about 175 people in the country are going to take 95%. People and financial firms are going to take 95% of the benefit out of this tax bill. He goes, I'm not proud of it, but it's what I do for a living. And I accept it. You know, it is what it is. But that system has gotten more and more broken. And it relies on, as you correctly point out, the purpose of the Republican Party is not to promote conservatism. It's not to promote personal integrity or the rule of law or the Constitution. It is to fuck people over in the middle and lower classes of this country and transfer a continued transfer of their autonomy, their cognitive liberty, their wealth over to people who are racing for a finish line financially, where this country does not look like a republic or a democracy of any kind. It looks like a kleptocracy.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. And that is, you know, whether no matter the color of your skin, no matter who you vote for, no matter how, you know, the tiniest town to the biggest city, if you are in the bottom two thirds of the economy, it is to build a system that doesn't work for you or respond to you. Things that 90% of people want do not happen in our political system unless a handful of people at the top decide, oh yeah, now this is a priority. And suddenly, like magic, the barriers disappear. It is a system that fails the fundamental test in our Constitution. Our Constitution says we need a Republican, this small r, Republican form of government. And the James Madison, I'm from Madison, named after James Madison, he says a Republican form of government is where all powers of the government are derived from the great body of the people. It is from the majority, the big majority of the people. That is where the power is supposed to come from. And that's not where it comes from right now. It comes from a small number of people in positions of extreme wealth and extreme power. And that there's still enough democracy in this country to change that and to ensure we have a government that's on the side of an economy that works for everyone. And we've done this before. We've done this after the Gilded Age. We had a progressive movement. We had this with the New Deal. We had, you know, Teddy Roosevelt talked about the malefactors of great wealth. And then we had, FDR came in and fought again. There are both parties. Like, it is possible to create this change. This is part of the American story. The reason why I still have a lot of hope, even in times that can feel really dark, is that there are enough tools in our toolkit that we can fight our way out of this mess. But it is a fight, because the people with the sometimes trillionaires of the world, the Elon Musk of the world, they want nothing more than to ensure that even if the public is furious, that the public cannot do anything about it.
That's right.
So they will like tooth and claw, and we need to be ready for that.
And having that, knowing that you're going to be in a fight, folks, knowing that it's going to be loud sometimes and ugly sometimes and noisy, and you're not going to be comfortable. That's, you mentioned Teddy Roosevelt. That's definitional in my version of the old Republican Party of, you got to engage in the big hard tasks. You've got to do the hard jobs, and you've got to make the big lift sometimes. And this book, folks, I think is one that is going to make a big difference. And so you are about to go out with This Is the Plan on a big tour. Talk to us about that real quick, Ben.
Absolutely. So kicking off in Madison, Wisconsin, my hometown, with Pete Buttigieg is going to come in. We're going to have a great conversation about it. Then we'll go across the country and across Wisconsin. So I'm going to be in different cities. I'll be in Chicago. I'll be in D.C., Boston, L.A., Seattle, San Francisco, and then in Wausau, Wisconsin, in Milwaukee, in Green Bay, La Crosse, in Eau Claire. This is, the first swing is packing in a bunch of these places. There's obviously many other places across the country and across the state I want to visit down the road, but I want to kick this off with a bang. And especially I want to thank
the people who made Wisconsin's comeback story possible. Because the story in this book is really the story of thousands of people who refused to give up even when it seemed like hope was lost in our state. There was, if you go back to 2016, 2017, Trump won, Ron Johnson beat Russ Feingold again, and then in 2017, no one ran against the far-right Supreme Court justice because the conventional wisdom was there was no way to win, that this was locked in. I quote someone who said, it looks like the Wisconsin Supreme Court will be controlled by conservatives for a generation. And it was only because thousands and thousands of people in every corner of our state rolled up their sleeves and started doing the work that we started winning. We had a Supreme Court victory in 2018. I moved home. I was living out of state. I moved home in 2018 and got to knock on doors all over the state for Tony Evers, for Tammy Baldwin, for running for state legislature. Step by step, we fought our way back. And I think no one should have any illusions that even if we win the midterms in 2026, that suddenly, you know, the lights will turn back on, everything will be fine. It's going to take years.
Right.
But there's
it is.
The good news is there's joy. There's joy in building power and being part of something bigger than yourself.
100%.
Part of 100%. The resurrection of the American idea, of the dream of this country, of being a country that has self-rule and self-government, and as a country that works for everybody. Being part of that, knowing that you were part of that, being able to tell your grandkids that in the time of greatest peril, you 100%. Helped to turn America into a democracy again that worked for everyone. That is a source of pride and joy that all of us can have. So the fact that it's hard, that's a reason to do this thing. It is not a reason to shy away from it. And that's been the Wisconsin story. I think that can be the country story.
And I think that's one thing that Wisconsin and you have particularly hit on properly is we were meant to be a conglomeration of states. Not everything was meant to be governed out of Washington, D.C. or out of the Oval Office. States were meant to build their own democracies, their own institutions. And I think in Wisconsin, you guys have kicked open that door, whereas the Republican system is the same everywhere. Florida Republicans have to believe exactly what Arizona Republicans and exactly what North Carolina Republicans, exactly what New York Republicans, they all have to believe the same one or two things. They don't have any state individuality anymore. Their confederacy is set by the Heritage Foundation in Washington, not the, you know, their old belief system. They've got one thing that they're told, and they're like, yep, that's what we believe right here. It's 100% the same. The homogeny is poison. Because you've approached this, while your model works everywhere, your best practices have all emerged out of how Wisconsin successfully did this. That's why I think this book is so valuable, because it really shows you, folks, here's the cookbook.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this is exactly right. The idea here is it's not a 50 state strategy. It's 50 state strategies. It is a strategy that makes sense in your state. And yep. the you know, the core, the one weird trick is to listen to people where you are. And that is something that you're going to hear something different everywhere. Democrats in Arizona will win differently than Democrats in Mississippi. And they'll win differently than Democrats in Montana. They'll win differently than Democrats in Alaska. And you know, in Alaska, great example of a state that's a multi-party coalition. There are independents, there are Democrats.
Alaska's a big old mess.
Well, but I think there's something great in that. I'm a proud Democrat, but this doesn't need to just be about Democrats. The uniting thread to me needs to be, you believe that the government should work for the people, and you think that everyone should be able to have a fair shot in this country. And if you can sign up for those two things, you think everyone's right to freedom should be protected, you think that we should work for working people. I don't care what jersey you're wearing. We need to build a huge coalition to be able to do this, because we're up against the biggest concentration of money and wealth and power that we've ever seen, maybe in world history. And it's going to take all of us to fight back against that. So you're exactly right. This is a moment when the unique character of each state, the unique history of each state, gives you the tools to fight in your own particular state. And you know, Wisconsin, as I talk about in the book, we have this deep progressive tradition. We also have a far right tradition. Joe McCarthy is from Wisconsin. The John Birch Society is based in Appleton, where I was Appleton, just Wisconsin. Now. They're the Bradley Foundation.
And on the affirmative side, you have the traditional Republican Party.
Yes.
Also came out of Wisconsin.
One of the great legacies of the state, the founding of the Republican Party and ripping Wisconsin as a anti-slavery party.
As an anti-slavery party. Yeah.
Yes. And that's, so all those things are there, just like across the country. You know, just about every state, you can find some thread of people fighting for greater freedom and progress for everybody. And you can find some thread of trying to create autocracy and, you know, racial domination and the worst trends in American history. And everywhere, it's up to us to find that root and grow something new from the best of our yeah. heritage and traditions
yeah.
and fight against the parts that we don't want to define our future. This is the whole country. We've been this gift to the world with some of the best things, the first peaceful transfer of power, this unbroken yep. string of, with one almost exception, you know, a couple, couple dark spots, right?
Yeah, a couple little speed bumps here and there, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But we've shown some of the greatest possibilities in ways that have inspired people who strive for freedom all over the planet. And also we are a country that's had some of the worst stains and worst disasters and, you know, everything from slavery to, now I think the war in Iran is an example of one of the worst foreign policy decisions that we've ever seen around the world.
Catastrophic.
It is so bad. It's so dumb and bad and needless. And they're, you know, like,
I mean,
Wisconsin, I was talking to a retired dairy farmer talking about how the cost of moving cheese and moving milk goes up when gas prices rise. And there are people lying dead, American and Iranian and tons of other people because of this war that did not have to happen. But my point is there's the good and the bad. And that is life. And the question is, which one are we going to build on and which one are we going to fight against?
Well, Ben, I got to ask you this one last question because my producers will kill me if I do not. Two last questions. What is, in your mind, there are people who are asking me a lot lately about the DSA stuff that's coming up in they won a lot of seats in New York and they had a big day in Colorado. And the Republicans are converting on that. They're turning the DSA thing into their 2026 campaign right now. Talk to us about what the appeal to Democratic voters is about the DSA candidates.
Sure. Well, if you look at DSA candidates that are winning, very often they're saying the system is broken. This isn't working for regular people. The you know, people in office are not fighting as hard and making the amount of change that is needed. And that is fascinating for a lot of voters. You also hear that from center-left Democrats that are winning primaries across the country. That is about an orientation towards fighting. Now, for some voters, there's an ideological appeal to the specific platform. For some, there's disillusionment with things that they've seen already.
Sure.
But one uniting thread is that in a ton of places, it's the people who've been building a party from below, who've been rolling up their sleeves and electing candidates to city council. Mm-hmm. You see this in New York, a decade of work by the DSA to elect people to local office, to build party machinery, to have folks in every apartment
farm
building.
Build a farm team, all that
doing
stuff.
The farm team. Mm-hmm. That is something that is not about any one ideology. That is about actually doing the work to build power in a democracy. And that's something right. that I think people everywhere can decide now, today, that you want to be part of to organize for the midterms. Maybe there's a primary coming up. Maybe it's the November election. And then keep going. Do not yes. stop after the midterms. Go all the way through 2028. When we get to the final hours of the election in 2028, and people are saying, you know, if you're in line, stay in line. The question of whether that election is a nail biter coming down to, you know, a few thousand votes in a couple of states, or whether it's a landslide, that question will have been determined by what all of us do for the next 2 years. Are we talking to people who are disillusioned, who have maybe tuned out? Are we talking to people who maybe took a flyer on voting for Trump this last time and don't feel like it's worked out? Or are we just staying in our own little bubbles talking to people who already agree with us about everything? And if we yeah. decide over and over to do the hard work of actually connecting with votes and building something bigger than we've ever needed before, then we can make 2028 a landslide election that allows the kind of change that this country is crying out for. And that is all of our job, no matter where we land on the political spectrum. If we don't like what's happening right now, it is time to change it.
Absolutely. Well, Ben Wickler, thank you, my brother, for coming on. I really appreciate you. Folks, go out and order this book. It comes out on the 21st of this month, of the month of July. It is amazing. This is the Plan, How to End America's Meltdown and Save Democracy by Ben Wickler. Also, check out This is Wisconsin, a great partnership that Ben has with Civic Media. And you're also on Substack, correct?
Yes.
You're on Substack.
This is Wisconsin.com, BenWickler.com, and this is theplan.com. Three great websites.
Awesome. 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 Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Ben. And we will talk to you again very soon.
Thanks so much, Rick.
The Lincoln Project Podcast is a Lincoln Project production. Executive produced by Whitney Hayes, Ben Howe, and Joey Wartner-Cheney. Edited by Riley Main. Hey, folks, if you want to support the Lincoln Project's work against Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and this MAGA craziness, go to action.lincolnproject.us/helplp. If you'd like to get in touch or have suggestions for a guest or a show topic, or just want to say hi, our email is podcast@lincolnproject.us. For our MAGA friends, please, no more nudes. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Good night, and good luck.